the interview with Bill Matthews on October 20th. Although you grew up in the Midwest and had a childhood there that seems a bit akin to those, say, Stanley Plumlee, to some extent Philip Levine, you don't go back to your Ohio and your upbringing with the same sort of mythic urgency which they insist upon. Myth for you seems to reside more in the imaginative life, in literature and jazz especially. Home for you seems to exist most crucially in art, in the delights of being an impassioned reader, a listener, a fan. Do you remember the first time you heard, the first time you were moved by something you read or a piece of music you heard?
I don't know if I remember the first time. It's certainly the case that for me, home is an invented place and not a given, and is, in, to a certain degree, therefore, is without geography. It's true that when I, you know, that often when I dream, if the dream is set outdoors, the landscape resembles southwestern Ohio. I'm not sure you can reprogram dreams to do anything but that. But in any case, I think it's true that that home has something to do with. It's a place that must be constantly imagined and peopled, and it has something to do with being wrapped. Has something to do with gauging as many of your faculties as possible. And home is a place where you're not bored. One might say. What it feels to me that I might have in common with Phil Levine's Midwestern childhood is not, I don't think, particularly Midwestern. It has to do with downward mobility, or sideways mobility. Phil's is more downward. What feels similar to me is a refusal to accept the comforts of the situation you were brought up in. And that means you have to invent something else. There's a rhyme, and an important one in some ways, between my childhood and Stan's, in that Stan grew up in a part of Ohio which is heavily populated by Quakers, and I grew up in a part of Ohio which is heavily populated by Amish and Mennonites. I think that worked in very different ways on the two of us, but there are sides of Stan's temperament that seem to me recognizable, and that I think have to do with finding the poise with which those people seem to me to be able to be in the world. And particularly as a counterpoint to his father, who was a figure of some Sturm und Drang, as one gathers from the poems. And in fact, the people I most admired when I was living in that part of Ohio, I didn't have a stormy family life. So it was less as an alternative and more as just a chance to watch other people exist in the world. But the Amish and the Mennonite farmers were the best farmers there and were mild, and I would describe them as being psychologically worldly, and that their ability to know how to get along and to be individuals in a community without having a big sense of an us versus them, of a one and many problem. That was interesting to me. Most of the other people I was around didn't know how to do that. Something that may contribute to this is the fact that I was born in 42. My father was in the Navy. I was a war baby. I lived part of my childhood with my grandparents, and then part of my childhood in a succession of places with my parents, and then my sister came along 3.5 years after I did. So that there isn't one prevailing physical place that's a home, and that may make it easier or more urgent to invent a sense of home. I don't know what's Midwestern in all of that, but Phil and Stan both have, and I probably do too, though I can see it less well in me than in them, just because we don't see ourselves very easily. A certain desperate Midwestern friendliness may be a link here.
Well, in terms of that, I mean, you talked a little bit about the home being a place of invention, and you've also mentioned a little bit about your childhood, but what do you think it was that set you on the pattern of life that's led you to this? I mean, how did your childhood contribute to your becoming a poet, or did it?
Well, it has to, and of course the interesting, the unfindable needle in the haystack is got something to do with the notion of, which almost everybody who takes it upon himself or herself to have theories about childhood is that what everybody agrees to be the most formative years are the years upon which an obligatory amnesia falls. You know, the first 2 years of your life are the crucial molding years, says everyone. And nobody can remember almost anything of this period, which actually makes it very easy to make such assertions because there's no evidence to contradict them is available. This seems to me the strangest thing in some ways about being human, is that this period that we all have a strong intuitive sense is incredibly important, is absolutely unavailable to us. But anyway, that in my early years, I either lived in somebody else's house. My grandparents were very affectionate, and I was treated like a little prince in some ways. But it wasn't my own house. They were older than my parents, and were very fond of children, rather sentimental about children even. But they've had children around for a lot of years, and I was near the very tail of the kite. And I think I had a lot of time on my hands there, too, where entertaining yourself was a survival skill. And then when I was living with my parents in the early years, we lived in the country. My father was a county agent for the Soil Conservation Service, the Department of Agriculture employee. And he did that for the first, 12 or 15 years of my life. And we always lived either at the edge of town or in the country. And there was you would go out to play and there were cornfields and a dog and the weather. And you had to invent something to make that landscape more interesting and less stark than it actually is. Of course, later on in school, the kinds of things for which you're punished as a small boy in school, promiscuous curiosity, daydreaming, staring moodily out the window, those are all the skills which we've discovered to our great pleasure were actually very useful after all. All our teachers were wrong. There was a lot of that for all of us, of course, in school. And the other thing to be said about the way childhood encourages you to think of an imagined life as being in some important way a real life, and not an opposition to or an escape from anything, is that the very thing that I wound up spending a very high amount of my adult life doing, which is reading books and listening to music, those were forms of daydreaminess and secession from the rest of the family that were acceptable. If you sat in a corner and sucked your thumb, people started wondering if the school psychologist shouldn't be consulted. If you sat in a corner reading a book and pointedly ignoring everybody, that was a sign that you were a good child. And so there were a lot of rewards aside from the trance of reading itself. We could go on long excursions away from the house and the family by just sticking your nose in a book. Mm-hmm.
Did the interest in music start just as early?
It came a little later. I grew up in a house with records, but not in a house where people just sat and listened to music. I mean, I'm perfectly capable of sitting for 3 or 4 hours at a time and listening to music, and I'm not uttering a word during that time and not doing anything else,
really?
Not reading or doing something, some other thing. And nobody in the house listened to music like that. But soon I discovered that it was like reading. It had great private rewards. It meant I was being a good child. Which, of course, I didn't care whether I was a good child or not. I just wanted to be a successful child, whatever that meant. But good or bad is somebody else's expectation of you at that age. And anything you can do to escape from that and to live in a world where it didn't matter what you were being good at the moment or not was valuable in and of itself. There was popular music, though I thought that the popular music of the late 40s and early 50s was actually pretty dull. It seemed to me reasonably somewhat dull then, though I didn't have much to compare it with.
Right.
I got into my early teens, I was interested already in classical music, and the music I liked most was Baroque music, Bach in particular. Bach through Haydn was my golden age. And then there were a couple of radio stations that you could get late at night that had what was still called race music, where you could listen to black rock and roll and its forerunners. And then life began to get interesting. And it also meant you could occasionally hear a little jazz on the radio. If I was listening to music or reading a book, I was doing something that my parents hoped for. So it's a licensed form of escape is one of the things about it.
When did the transition into wanting to make the art happen?
Well, I took piano lessons when I was young. Mine was not the kind of family. I was never sent away to camp in the summer. And I wasn't trucked out for a series of soccer, not like a certain kind of suburban kid who takes every lesson and participates in every sport. I did play Little League Baseball because I liked baseball a lot. And my father was a baseball fan and played amateur ball into his late 30s. He was a catcher and managed a local team. And so there were some evenings when I was a kid where we sat in the bleachers on some ball field and watched these aging ball players, scuffle. So it made sense that I was going to do that. I think I probably asked for piano lessons, and that drizzled off. Later I took clarinet lessons, and I stayed with that a little longer, but I wasn't good enough. You figure that out fairly early on, it turns out, and that your fantasies of what it will lead to are corrected by the fact that it doesn't leave. The way when your curiosity is and your abilities to satisfy it are in sync with one another, you know, you don't think this is going to lead to a career. You think this will lead to the next piece, and it will be really interesting. You still have to learn how to play cross again, or back to the piano. But anyway, you know, there's that one little Mozart sonata that everybody can play. Mm-hmm. Then the time you have to do the second one. And you realize you're going to have to do technical things that you don't possess yet. If you're really good, what it leads to is the pleasure of learning that, and it leads to the pleasure of learning the third thing, which is even more difficult. You're not sitting there picturing yourself on the cover of Time magazine. You're thinking, you know, in another couple of months, I can really do one of the late sonatas. That'll be fun. Mm-hmm. And when you're not good, it doesn't lead anywhere except to the next lesson.
Yeah.
and every step is one at a time. I mean, it's pedestrian. And that was useful information. Probably the highest thing a musical career would have led me to was a chance to teach students as indifferently skilled as myself. And this seemed purgatorial.
Was there an analogous sort of pattern of discovery in writing poems?
Well, no. I mean, when I started teaching myself to write poems, I never had a creative writing class. This was by accident of where I went to school. No high schools offered them in those years. Zippier high schools now do. Like most of the Ivy League schools, disdain teaching creative writing. So there was never a course to take. I might well have drifted into one if there had been. So when I started to teach myself to write poems, I found, in fact, that the process I couldn't make happen in music, that some equivalent of it was available in writing. I mean, you could write a poem, and it made possible writing another poem, and it made possible writing another poem. And when I started, I wasn't thinking of putting a book together. I started writing poems, and I loved the quality of attention it drew from me, and I loved the activity, and you just kept writing poems. And then you got to a certain point, and you think, well, now there's to do something with these. Then, for the first time in some way, I thought, well, there's a product here. But what I was really interested in at first was simply the way the curiosity sort of rolled out in front of you, like a rug before the eye of a cartoon, and it just kept working.
Were you writing in high school?
I wrote a few poems in high school, and I wrote a few poems in college, and for the usual reasons, either I was incredibly sad or I wanted to impress a girl, or both. And I didn't really start writing poems until I was out of college. And then, as a sort of prophylaxis against graduate school, which I came to as a graduate student in English Lit, and I came to dislike not English Lit or graduate school per se, but it wasn't the right place for me, and I could tell. And I needed to do something to prevent myself from being overwhelmed by having made what seemed a reasonable and sensible choice that, you know, immediately, instantly when I had begun this path, I realized it was a dreadful choice, and I had no idea how I could have done something so foolish to myself that displayed so little self-knowledge, etc. You know, better to start writing bright poems than to try to solve insoluble problems like that. Or they were at least insoluble if you posed them in the terms I just suggested.
Well, why don't we talk about your first book or your early work? That those poems seem very rooted in some of the period styles of the 60s and 70s, you know, the short imagistic poems, Merwin and Wright, lie sometimes as influences, who you've written about in your essay. How did you get attracted to that sort of writing, that deep image writing that was in the fashion then?
Yale also didn't administer courses in very recent poetry. You went further into the modern era than Oxford and Cambridge did. In those days, they taught nothing after 1900, I believe. But at Yale, you didn't go much past 1945 or so. And I didn't really have much idea of what was out there. I started buying books and reading stuff that other people around me were reading. I had never read Retke's essay, How to Write Like Somebody Else. It took me about 2 years to get to reading Retke in any form. If I had, I might have figured out that it would be interesting to systematically imitate somebody. Mm. But what I did was I wound up imitating the zeitgeist in a way. I mean, I wrote in a period style, and it had one advantage for me, the prevailing short, heavily metaphorical poems. I mean, the short was the biggest advantage, because when you're trying to teach yourself how to write, one of the things you want to do is go on. If you're working in a form that allows you to go on until you make a terrible blunder, and the possibility is you're already pretty close to the end of the poem by that point, it's happened. You know, they were short because it was what I could manage. Mm-hmm. It takes a while to teach yourself how to get a poem, how to keep a poem going. I wrote these very short poems, which you could say of that kind of poem, that it begins and it starts to end almost simultaneously. And I thought I could make something the structural integrity of which would hold up if it were comparatively small, and that if I did enough of that, I could learn to go on longer. So I think the short was probably a very important part of the attraction for me. I have a metaphorical imagination or bent. I had one just as a speaker, as a kid, before I ever wrote things down. And so the idea that the making of metaphors is a kind of thought that had occurred to me in some natural and un-theoretical way at a fairly early age. And so I thought, oh, this doesn't feel dawningly difficult, I thought. It was more difficult than I first thought, but it was something I could do.
In terms of starting with those early models, I mean, did you feel as though you were part of something very quickly and a part of a period movement, or did you identify with...
Well, yes and no. I mean, I identified... I like James Wright's poems a lot for reasons I didn't understand at the time. I like Merwin's poems a great deal. And it took me a while to realize that one of the things that was interesting to me about them is that they were poems by somebody who was rather learned and well-educated, who had figured out a way to write without wearing that.
Uh-huh.
And two of the poets who are about my own age, whom I ran into first, one by geographical accident, was Robert Morgan, was living in Raleigh in those years, and used to come over to Chapel Hill a lot. And I was sent Charles Simic's first book, and actually reviewed it for what was nearly the, probably the third or fourth issue of Little Blair. And I felt attracted to some things in both of their work a lot. But I didn't feel part of a movement in any large sense, and I didn't have the same enemies. In fact, I mean, I was too naive literarily to have any enemies. I wasn't reacting to much of anything except probably unconsciously reacting to a rather Augustan undergraduate experience in the Yale English department. On the other hand, I was very grateful for that. The English exam that you took there to qualify for an honors degree was a sit-down exam, and you sat down and wrote an essay, and here was the question. It was one question. They gave us five different translations into English of the same passage from the Odyssey, and the question was, date the translation and give your reasons for the date. Name the translator if you know him or have a good guess. And finish each of the five sections of your essay by describing any recognizable features of the way the verse is operating that belong to a particular period in literary history. And I had an education well enough that you could answer that. And I never regretted it. I've always been very grateful for it. But if you're starting out to write, you have to turn your back on some of that stuff for a while, because the issues of decorum and issues that could pretty well be identified by reading a copy of Understanding Poetry rather closely are not helpful to a young poet trying to teach himself how to write. And so that education was hardly an enemy, but it wasn't going to be useful to me until I'd done some stuff of my own during a period when I ignored it and pretended with middling success that I didn't know those things.
Well, I'm just thinking when you bring up the Merwin and Wright and thinking how the interest in those short, subjective, surrealist poems also starts to manifest itself in your work and the interest in the epigram.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Horace was Wright's favorite poet, and I know he's one of yours.
Always. And there are a couple, I mean, I can think of a couple of poets, not contemporaries, who interested me a great deal as a reader when I was that age, but whom I didn't know how to make any use of in terms of writing poems. So I'm thinking of Auden and Byron. With both of whom I came to feel some temperamental rhyme as a reader very early, but I didn't know enough. I didn't know enough literature, I didn't know enough about how to write to make any particular use of them. And so it was like reading Stevens at that age. I thought, I know this guy is terrific, but I don't understand these poems yet. So I'm going to turn my back on it for a while and come back when I have a better chance of figuring out what I can do here. It also allowed me to put some of that stuff aside on a kind of to-do later when you're grown up shelf. I found it a very useful model. To the extent that poems in that tradition, this is less true of Merwin, it seems to me, than some of the other poets, are almost never about a social world. That seemed to me a defect of those poems. That didn't mean I wouldn't use the style to help teach myself some rudimentary things about learning how to write, but it always seemed to me that the way in which they took place in an unpeopled landscape was a problem for me, whose imagination is more social in a number of ways than some of those poets were.
I think Fury South, you seem to run its course pretty quickly, though, in terms of finding a different voice. It seems like around the third book, Rising and Falling, mm-hmm. poems change quite a bit. What were you conscious of at that time?
I don't know how much of it was conscious, but a lot of what seemed to be aesthetic decisions, mm-hmm. and particularly if you take a narrative interest in your own life or career,
right.
are really made on a much more inarticulate level than that. And I mean, for me, a major thing that happens is that I get bored, and you write a certain number of poems that have certain things in common, and after a while you've begun to solve whatever the problems that you could elicit from that style or that form or whatever, that body of subject matter. You get to the point where you really begin to know pretty well what you're doing. As I near that point, I get bored and I get eager to get stupid again and to take on something I don't know how to do yet. I think some of it was a fairly subliminal sense of that. You know, also there was subject matter that I was interested in writing about. A lot of the sort of imagist slash deep image poems were about the assumption that subject matter was a stand-in for something else. In that sense, they're sort of Freudian, that you know, there's a latent and a manifest content. Though I think Jung may be the presiding theoretician to those poems rather than Freud, but there's still that sense that the poem is a vehicle to get at something which is unspoken or unspeakable behind that. That's in fact not the way I think of poems. I think of poems as having engagements with subject matter which produces something that isn't subject matter and that really is poetry. But that, for me at least, I need to have it in order to write. Andy Warhol once invited Mingus to come out to East Hampton to discuss making a film. Mingus had written the score for Cassavetti's movie Shadows, and it was a big hit among the hip. And so he went out to East Hampton and kept saying, well, what are we going to do? And Warhol said, well, we're going to improvise. And, you know, after about a day of this, Mingus turned and went off in a huff. And he could go off in quite a huff, given his size and authority. And he says, you can't improvise on nothing, man. And, there's, you know, for me, in some sense, the subject matter are like chord changes. They're not what poems are about, but there's something about subject matter, as there is about memorizing the chord changes to a really beautiful song, that allows you to get to the thing which isn't subject matter and is poetry, which is a transmutation. But it's not about something that's not said. It's
right.
finally about that thing that you make out of the chord changes or out of the subject matter. And so in that sense, those engagements with subject matter were very important. And the way those images, poems, seemed to be on some level queasy about having subject matter and treated the subject matter as a kind of distraction. The way language poets think of certain kinds of plot as a kind of the opiate of the masses,
yeah.
which you have to get rid of in order to find out what's really going on. For me, it's never the point, but it's always been the vehicle.